listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, and every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between what's going on for our personal health and well-being and how that connects to what's going on in our communities, in our society, in our public policies, and on planet Earth. Every week for the last 4 years and counting on Connect the Dots, we've discussed different facets of all the things in our world that really impact our health and our lives and well-being. We've talked to experts, advocates, thought leaders, all kinds of authors, all scientists, all kinds of different people on the show discussing all the different range of facets that are going on in our complex world. I had begun some 25 years ago reporting on integrative health treatments and what we could do in terms of self-help to better our health, and over time I've come to feel that one of the best things we can do is to be active, proactive, and informed citizens. And the show reflects my own transformation and conversion to that viewpoint as the key entree point for really protecting our health, the well-being of all we care about, and life on Earth itself. Over the last 10, 11 months of this year, we're now in the 10th month of the year. Beginning in early in the year, I've been doing extensive coverage of the so-called trade deals, Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, Fast Track, which is an authority given to the president to sign or pass these kinds of treaties. The debate over all of that has been something I've covered on the show since early in the beginning of 2015, and now we're returning to that today. And joining me on today's show is someone who has been one of the leading authorities and guests on this show that we've turned to time and again for updates, for information, and now I'm happy to say he's back with us today for the latest news as things have developed and are moving ahead in some kind of fashion, and we'll find out exactly what kind of fashion that is as we talk today with Bill Warren, a senior trade analyst for Friends of the Earth. He has worked for a long time to protect the environment from the negative impact of international trade and investment agreements, and he is an established policy area expert in that specific area with a strong background as former policy director at the Forum on Democracy and Trade and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. So I'm delighted to have you back with us today, Bill, to kind of give a sort of bridge and an update where we've been on these treaties movements and where we're going. Welcome back to Connect the Dots.
Well, thank you so very much, Allison. I appreciate this.
When last we talked, I think we probably talked in the spring, and at the time that we were talking, it was like filling in all the background about many of the ways that these treaties would impact our environment, our food supply, our health care. Our ability to regulate toxic chemicals, to curb climate change, to do all of these different things. And I know that when you began appearing on the show and began discussing these things, many people were really, frankly, in disbelief. How could the president, how could Congress, how could our elected officials possibly be trying to kind of organize this huge, global, monopolistic treaty structure that would even supersede American law and global law in nations all across the world and take away so many of our rights have been hard fought for and won to protect all that we hold dear in those arenas. So you're really part of the wake-up call on this program and through some blogs I did, reaching and through your own very active work and international dialogue with trade experts around the world, spreading the word from a time when people couldn't believe this was happening. We're certainly, I remember in some of the earlier shows we did, we were talking about, well, the vote will be coming up soon. No, it'll be in another few weeks. You know, we didn't really know. Now we can see, you know, that it did move through Congress, the fast-track vote about whether the president had authority to sign deals that were unknown, whose contents were unknown, unrevealed to the general public, and kind of inaccessible to most members of Congress for various reasons. So many people couldn't even believe that that would happen. But that fast-track bill did come to Congress, where it really had a much tougher fight than I think the president and congressional leaders and senatorial leaders expected, because of the mounting public pushback against these treaties and this authority to pass them sight unseen. So nevertheless, they passed. The fast-track authority passed, and that happened in June of this year. So can you kind of reflect a little bit on that fight, and then we'll kind of move forward to talk about what has happened since then, so that listeners are really fully up to speed on what's going on?
Sure. The fast-track fight was one we almost won. In fact, it was defeated in the House at one point and then resuscitated. Then the Senate acted, and it got through the Senate with only one vote margin, and back to the House in a different procedural mode, and the bill was passed with only eight members, a margin of only eight members in the House. So it was a razor-thin victory for President Obama and Wall Street and the big polluting corporations, but what's the upshot of it is that while the fast-track procedures for consideration of trade agreements do make it easier to get a deal like the Trans-Pacific Partnership through, but in this case, the margin of victory was so razor thin on the fast-track vote that Ambassador Froman, who works in the White House as our U.S. Trade Representative, had to go to Maui to try to finish the deal, and the talks totally collapsed because he was unable to make certain compromises without alienating and turning his fast-track friends in some circumstances in Congress into Trans-Pacific Partnership enemies. And that was a catastrophe for the administration and the corporations, but in the last few days they did pull together a last-minute deal in Atlanta, Georgia, and it's clear that President Obama has decided to roll the dice with Congress by making concessions to Japan in particular, but also to other negotiating parties that are going to anger many of the supporters and many of the industries that were supporters of fast track. So the future of the Trans-Pacific Partnership agreement in Congress is very uncertain, and many think that it's more likely than not going to be defeated.
That's extraordinary. So it was like they created a coalition with these congressional leaders who were sponsored or supported or funded by various corporate friends or sponsors or donors. They created a coalition hoping to, with the expectation that then they were going to get certain deals through under the umbrella of these bigger deals. But when they had to actually then turn around and negotiate with other countries about this, some of those expectations collapsed because there was more pushback than anticipated from countries around the world. What were some of the sticking points?
Well, the big sticking point It was autos and auto parts. Japan insisted on the right that all tariffs and duties on imports of, or almost all tariffs and duties on imports of Japanese cars be dropped, and furthermore, that those cars made in Japan could be made primarily with auto parts made by, exploited labor in China and also in Thailand. Mm. And so what we see now is with the announcement of the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, the Ford Motor Company and all the big auto companies are on the warpath and vowing to defeat the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal. And there were several other cases where this happened. So basically the big winners in the negotiations in Atlanta were Wall Street and Big Pharma, which won the right to, they call this the death clause in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. They protect patent rights for so-called biologics of vaccines and cancer-fighting drugs for 8 years. And if you have cancer, you can't wait for 8 years to get your medicine. And if you're a poor person in the developing world, neither you nor your government can afford to pay Pfizer or one of the other big pharma companies $600 or $700 for a bottle of pills. And this was the thing that they were willing to sell out some industries in order to protect Big Pharma and to protect Wall Street deregulation that would roll back some of the protections that were provided in the Dodd-Frank bill and similar legislation around the world in response to the financial crisis and the Great Recession. So it's going to be a totally different calculus on the TPP, and we can win this fight and protect our food, protect our environment, protect our climate.
Because now we're joined. We not only have the auto workers, but we have the automobile manufacturers.
Exactly.
For example. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there are other industries as well that are going to back away or completely turn on the president's coalition.
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, the president, in order to get the deal passed for his primary group, Wall Street and pharma, as described, was willing to throw other industries under the bus, so to speak, or had to, couldn't prevail on those.
That's exactly what happened. Very succinctly put.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Recently we've heard that Hillary Clinton has, there's word is out in the media that Hillary Clinton has come out against the TPP after this prolonged silence about it and failure to take a stand on it. Some feel that, we're seeing a wonderful thing where, the pressure exerted by a progressive candidate like Bernie Sanders has persuaded, Clinton to move toward in the left direction and oppose the TPP. It's not my view because she didn't actually say she opposed it. She said she didn't like the deal that was wrought. Which suggests that she, if she were in the White House, might attempt to tinker with it more in some kind of manner along the lines that you're describing. Maybe she's rejecting it because the coalition of who's in and who's out won't be successfully able to pass it. What is your view of her recent announcement that people have interpreted to mean that she opposes the TPP?
Well, she was signaling that she was likely to oppose it, but all the major press reports headlined that she is now in opposition. There's no question that she was feeling the heat of public opinion and the heat that Bernie Sanders has put on her in the primary campaigns, which his message is really going over well with the public in terms of income inequality and fairness, and also trade deals. So this is her very lawyerly and carefully crafted statement is going to be very helpful, because it's a signal to pro-Wall Street and pro-corporation Democrats that Hillary definitely does not have their back right now, and that, in fact, she may leave them politically exposed and make a more forthright statement of opposition in the future. But you're very astute to note that it was an artfully worded statement. And we have to be careful about that, because when Barack Obama was running for president in 2008, and he faced similar pressures to respond to public concern about trade agreements, he promised to renegotiate NAFTA, and he promised to reform or eliminate these private investor courts, you know, the investor state mm-hmm. dispute resolution for the wonks in the audience. And then as soon as he had clinched the nomination, he went back and parsed his and explained that his previous language meant that he had plenty of room to change his mind based on subsequent developments. And in fact, he let his guard down a little bit, and actually told Fortune magazine that sometimes you say things in primary campaigns just to get the nomination, which was a statement against interest, as lawyers say. But I think that Clinton's move is very helpful. It's a step forward, but it's not the full thing, and we need a more definite and convincing statement in opposition and active opposition to the deal as it's presented in Congress from Hillary Clinton. And we may get that, we may not. Let's see.
As it's, you know, with the deal now agreed to, has it actually been signed at the time that we are having this conversation? I mean, because I know there were announcing the deal is almost there, it's almost there, there was going to be a press conference that was delayed. Is it actually signed, or are they still sort of dotting the I's and T's and all of that?
No, the lawyers are still arguing over the exact language. They've got a deal in principle, mm-hmm. and they'll eventually work out the legal details, but not after a lot of wrangling by the trade lawyers from 12 different countries. Because the devil is in the details. This is a very, very complicated legal document, and a comma here and a word there can make a big difference in terms of tribunal decisions and that sort of thing. So I think it'll take them a month, maybe less, maybe more, to resolve the final text, and they'll initial that, and President will give his notice to Congress, and then it's 90 days under fast track rules before they can have a vote on the bill. At that point, the Trans-Pacific Partnership will no longer be secret. When it's presented to Congress, we will see the details. It's a massive deal. You know, it could take a team of scholars years to totally unpack the fine points. It's not enough time to review it. But we will have more definite information, and probably more incriminating information about what is in this deal after this period. The soonest we can see a congressional vote on the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal would be maybe February 15th, but I think it's going to be later than that, and indeed it may even slip to the so-called lame duck session after the November elections still in 2016, because these trade agreements and the Trans-Pacific Partnership in particular are extremely unpopular with the American public, and frankly members of Congress running for re-election don't want that baggage, and they want to reward their campaign contributors, but they don't want to lose their seat. So it's going to be I think it'll be a slow process that may not get resolved until until December of 2016, although it could come up as soon as February, so people shouldn't, you know, should remain vigilant.
Mm-hmm. How would you compare, you know, the rapid, I would say it's pretty much a rapid rise in public awareness. Do you feel that that's just in, you know, in the progressive community, or has it really penetrated further into the American public where people are aware of and disliking this? I mean, from when we began, you know, talking about it earlier this year, how do you get a sense of how broad and deep that awareness is?
Well, there's very broad and deep opposition from to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement from the American public. And although the mainstream media largely reflected, their advertisers' self-interest in promoting these deals, because, you know, all these media companies now are owned by big corporations, not even by rich families, you know, who have a little more independence.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we've seen is people getting out the message to the public by old-fashioned means, like organizing meetings in union halls and in Sierra Club chapters around the country, and a lot of door-to-door canvassing by groups. Certainly we did that. And also the new social media, Twitter, Facebook, you know, email messages, and, of course, all the electronic advocacy techniques that have been developed in recent times. And it's fair to say that that this warning went viral. You know, it was sort of like Paul
mm-hmm.
Revere's ride in
mm-hmm.
Boston when the British were coming. And, you know, he had to ride and shout, and we have
mm-hmm.
the Internet.
Mm-hmm. If this treaty were passed, if these other treaties were passed, how might they affect the Internet and the capacity of the people to stay informed and engaged via the Internet? Would they have a harmful effect on that in any way?
Well, one of the big winners in the Atlanta negotiations are the media companies and the big corporations who seek to control the Internet, reduce or eliminate Internet freedom, make it expensive, you know, for people to use and to, in effect, censor what is easily distributed on the Internet. And this is one of the reasons we got such a fantastic response, because the people who are really wired in, you know, the 21-year-olds who are, experts in this technology and spend all their time online, caught on to this, and so it went viral, and they pushed it out aggressively, and the Internet Freedom campaign, which is very much a kind of self-generated, organic movement, has really had an impact in terms of opposing the TPP.
So that's really interesting, because that emphasizes the need for the public will to prevail in this instance, because if it were not to be the case and then there was a shutdown, then it would be without those freedoms. It would be, and given the corporate buyout in the media that you describe, and that, you know, after 30 years in the media, I'm certainly very well aware of, you know, we wouldn't maybe have another opportunity on another issue if those freedoms go away, because that's the communication channel for the public awakening, the public will, and all the rest of it. So this is really a fight that we must win, really. Let me just backtrack a bit to some other themes that we've talked about. One of the things that was said earlier, where people, you know, like 6 months ago, when people were kind of wringing their hands and saying, well, if this was all so bad, you know, why would President Obama be championing it to this extent? And, you know, a lot of people, there was a kind of lag at the outset because people couldn't believe that he would be doing that. And one of the rationales offered was that the most, you know, all of these other egregious provisions that we're talking about were inconsequential, because the key thing was that this would somehow maintain American and Western eminency by containing China in some kind of way. As the treaty has evolved and the situation with China has evolved, is it really serving that purpose, or is that, was that a sort of weak idea to begin with that was never going to happen? What is the status of that currently?
Well, I think it was always primarily a PR thing, you know, appeal to patriotism, rattle the saber, they say, you know, in order to, tell the people that they're, you know, we're threatened by foreign enemies, and then we have to do some tough things to save the republic and our way of life. I mean, that's the oldest form of demagoguery. To say that this in some way counters China's economic rise is a great big joke, because they just cut a deal in Atlanta that will allow the Chinese to supply a good portion of the parts that go into Japanese cars that will then be shipped to the United States. And because the parts are made by people who, by workers who don't make any money and don't have any rights and are cheap, they'll be under, they'll be able to undersell the cars made in the U.S. with union labor, and if somehow this deal, I mean, just to the contrary, it's this deal is very good for China.
How ironic! I mean, because. In other words, all the standards are lower, and this really works against American viability with all of that, although it may be good for the companies who are, you know, now multinational and don't have that particular loyalty to this country. I mean, that's kind of an across-the-board phenomenon in many different arenas with these deals, is it not?
Well, that's right. I mean... A company may have U.S. management and have a headquarters, but, you know, their operations are overseas, and in their behavior they show no loyalty to the country in which they're incorporated. And the classic example of that is Nike, which has a big headquarters in the suburbs of Portland, Oregon, and they have a few thousand very highly paid people, executives or people who are doing their advertising work, and, you know, some of their high-end designers and so forth. But Nike makes its shoes in countries where there are no labor rights, Vietnam in particular, which is a communist dictatorship. They don't have regular labor unions. The people who make the Nike shoes are woefully underpaid, working in unhealthy conditions, many of them women who are exploited. And, it's real cheap to make those expensive Nike shoes. And there are people in the top ranks of Nike in Portland who are doing well. And I assume that they spend their money liberally, and it may help, you know, the local merchants and the local economy a little bit. But the harm done to the American economy and our geopolitical strength is enormous. We used to make those kind of shoes here in the United States with union labor, and it was a fair price because the people who did the work were compensated. Those poor workers in shoe factories, many of them underaged and exploited, you know, they're not doing well at all.
Yeah, this is in other words, when we create that bifurcation where we are ignoring what goes on there, then in effect we're also importing those values into this country with products created, you know, without a fair living wage. They're then competing with us. So in the very act of allowing that and kind of looking the other way, we're actually digging our own grace simultaneously. It's quite a perfect example of what goes around comes around, but it's one that nobody will really want to be living with, I don't think, although people would be if this passes. So, you know, the trajectory that you just sketched, I mean, initially when we were talking about fast track, it was felt, you know, if this goes into the election, there's going to be a problem. It sounds like this will be the theme of the next election, given the timetable that you're sketching.
Well, that's why I think it's most likely to come to a vote within days after the election. But this session of Congress, for this upcoming session of Congress for 2016, will just be concluding, and they'll have 4 weeks or so to pass it. And actually, this has been a game plan for the passage of previous trade agreements, both the North American Free Trade Agreement and the World Trade Organization Agreement, were passed in the lame duck after an election year. Mm-hmm. And that's because the politicians don't want to cut their throats. But once the election's over, they have data that show that the public's memory is only about 9 months or so. And now it's going to be 2 years before the next election in December 2016. And furthermore, a lot of those members of the House and the Senate will be retiring. And the pattern these days is for 75% of those congressional retirees to take multi-million-dollar jobs in corporate lobby firms and in corporate law firms, you know, pushing the corporate agenda to their old colleagues. So I think that's a vulnerable time, but that's no reason for defeatism, because there is such a surging tidal wave of opposition among the public to what is in this Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, and it's not just among progressives, environmentalists, people who care about safe food and organics. It's people on the conservative side who are worried about our national sovereignty and, you know, conservative values like that, and who have a more correct analysis on the geopolitics and whether or not China wins or loses than President Obama apparently has. So we expect that there will be very substantial Republican opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal from people, you know, you don't really care for in many, many other respects, but they have their own reasons for opposing it.
I've found that in dialogue with people often. I mean, I know just what you're talking about. You know, I mean, the sovereignty issue actually should be a big issue for everyone. You know, and also the notion, I mean, it's certainly, you know, people that want to pare down government, I don't know that their intention in paring down government was to make government and the will of the people irrelevant, and so that, you know, our elected officials are in the higher of those who pay their campaign, you know, contributions and pay for their campaigns, their donors and whatever, and lobbyists, and then they go and work for those people. So, of course, they don't care about sustaining government, citizen engagement, or anything that the people want, because they've already, you know, been hired, they are hired, and they're going to work for this new system. So, in effect, they're trying to secure their future job, not their current job as elected officials. And this is a tremendous corruption and perversion of the role of elected officials. And it kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy to those who, you know, feel that government interference is always the problem. I mean, they've actually, through that belief and the failure to kind of fight for democratic infrastructures, you know, and civic infrastructures, they've actually created this situation or contributed to this situation. But at the end of the day, if you undermine that, you are undermining American sovereignty. And so I think that when it's hitting that bottom line, maybe there's a big wake-up happening around that, hopefully.
Well, I think also with the retirement of John Boehner as Speaker of the House, I mean, the fast-track deal got through on the skin of its teeth in the House because of Boehner's skill as a legislative tactician and his ability to intimidate, arm twist, persuade people, Republicans in his own caucus who were inclined to to vote against Fast Track, and it was a credit to his parliamentary skills. I mean, this guy's no rocket scientist, but he understands the people element of politics very well, and he's burned out and tired, and he's been quite frank about the crazies in the Republican Party in the U.S. House of Representatives, and he can't take it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that without Boehner there to unite the Republicans, or at least enough of them to squeak through on a deal, they're going to have a very hard time to getting the Trans-Pacific Partnership through the House, even in the lame duck.
You know, that's an interesting. I was going to ask you about that. Among the chief players in the Senate and the House, who were the ones that were really the big champions? And Boehner, you know, certainly leading the pack there in the House. I mean, how many of them are left standing in a position to still be championing this, or have any of the others, you know, been undercut or shift their view based on we fought hard to get this and now it's not what we want, or, you know, is everyone, who besides Boehner may have shifted position with, you know, in the face of what the treaty actually contains?
Well, there are certainly a lot of Southern Republicans who are now looking at the closure of Japanese auto plants in their district, non-union auto plants that pay less than Detroit workers but still pay a lot more than workers in Chinese auto parts factories. And this deal will probably result in the closure of many or most of those Japanese assembly plants in largely in the South. And, you know, the South is dominated by the most right-wing section of the Republican Party. And so I think that those folks are going to, they will be hearing, you know, from local people about the threat that this deal poses to closures of plants. Another problem is that one of the good things that President Obama did was that he agreed with other countries that the investment court provisions whereby corporations can sue governments for millions or billions of dollars for the cost of complying with public interest rules and regulations. One of the big offenders has been Philip Morris, which has been intimidating governments all over the world with threats of multi-billion-dollar lawsuits if they seek to provide for anti-smoking programs like plain packaging or warning on packages. They say that's a violation of their intellectual property rights under international trade law. And the president took a personal interest in this. And furthermore, Australia, which has been sued by Philip Morris and others, were insistent it was no deal unless there was some kind of protection against Philip Morris lawsuits. That's one of the good things. I mean, I hate that investment chapter, but at least Philip Morris is going to get it in the neck, as they will deserve to. But who is the majority leader of the Senate? Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the champion of Philip Morris, and he's on the warpath. And there are many tobacco state supporters of Fast Track who are now threatening or definitely announced that they're going to vote against the Trans-Pacific Partnership unless they go back in and renegotiate and give Philip Morris what they want. Now, these people are not conservatives in the sense of people who have some sense of integrity about national sovereignty. These people are people in pay of the tobacco lobby, the death lobby, and of course there are a lot of local tobacco farmers in their districts. But this is the kind of thing that happened in Atlanta that means that the Fast Track vote will not accurately predict the vote on Trans-Pacific Partnership. You're going to see a lot of those tobacco state members switch sides.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
for the
what
wrong
about
reasons, but switching sides nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. What about other countries getting this passed around the world? I mean, you know, like what you're describing is, you know, there's so much of a I win, you lose to this that, the other countries that are you know, partners to this agreement, you know, they have tremendous difficulty taking it on the chin and forcing their people to take it on the chin so that, you know, some of these companies can have their way. Will there be problems in other places? Like, what happens if the people of Australia or elsewhere are like, no, we don't really, you know, we don't want this, and, you know, you're out of here if you're pushing this on. You know, what's happening in other parts of the world in response to
this? That's a very astute question, because your hypothetical, you know, is being validated in several instances. Most notably, the Malaysian trade minister left the talks in Atlanta before they were done. In other words, he walked out. It's not at all clear that Malaysia, which is a pretty important country economically, it's not clear whether Malaysia will be in. Furthermore, Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada, was forced to call elections, and it's at least a 50-50 shot, maybe better than that, that a social democratic party called the New Democrats will defeat the conservatives and in alliance with the old Liberal Party, or maybe the Parti Québécois, form a new government. And the leader of the New Democrats is not going to buy this deal. And even the leader of the Liberals, which are kind of sort of like the Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, part of the political spectrum in Canada, you know, pro-corporate, but good on human rights and things like that. Even the leader of the Liberals, Justin Trudeau, the son of the former Prime Minister, Pierre, has indicated that he would be more likely than not be opposed to joining the TPP, although his statement was very artfully worded, like Hillary's.
Mm-hmm. What
so
about
Canada,
Ron?
Canada,
yeah, Canada.
And Malaysia are two outstanding examples. Another possibility is Australia, because remember, all these other countries have parliamentary systems, meaning that they don't have to fight as hard to get one of these things approved, because the government is formed by the majority in the parliament, and if the government loses a vote, then the government falls and they have to call elections. So it's much easier to get these things approved in a parliamentary system. Nonetheless, the coalition for the majority, the conservative coalition for the majority in the Australian parliament, consists largely of the Tory party, the conservatives, but it also includes something called the National Party, which is basically a party of conservative, well-to-do farmers in the outback and places like that, and their votes are needed by the Tories to maintain their government. And this National Party, which includes big sugar growers, is threatening to break up their coalition if they don't get what they want on sugar. And I haven't seen the text, but it doesn't look like they've got it. Now this is hardly a sure thing, because it may not be in their interest, when push comes to shove, to actually break up the coalition, because then Labor might win the next election immediately. But there's going to be a lot of pushback. Of course, the problem is that a lot of these negotiating partners are not democracies. Vietnam is a communist dictatorship. Brunei is an absolute monarchy ruled under a harsh form of Sharia law, which discriminates is too soft a word, which persecutes women and gays and others. There are all kinds of human rights abuses in Mexico, and the list goes on. So in some cases, certainly not in Vietnam or Brunei, do these governments have to be concerned about public opinion. They will sign it.
So this is, you know, who we're holding hands with, to our shame, you know. Go ahead. I hear you. I'm about to say something there.
I think I want to follow up on Malaysia. one of the things that Barack Obama did to smooth this deal through was that he had Secretary Kerry manipulate what was supposed to be a totally objective report of the worst violators of human rights related to human trafficking, which most of which is trafficking in young children and women, both for sexual exploitation and labor exploitation, like on palm oil plantations in Malaysia. And they politically changed that report to move Malaysia up from the very worst category to the second worst category, whereas U.S. law would have forbidden the application of fast-track rules as they applied to Malaysia, as long as they were regarded as as long as they were scored as among the worst violators, of women and workers under this trafficking in humans provision. This was exposed in a leak by Reuters, which got insiders saying that, it was a totally dishonest deal. And even the foreign policy establishment, the Council on Foreign Relations, a very conservative group, has blasted this as just totally improper and a violation of human rights. But that goes to show the extent to which they're willing to go to get this deal approved. And this is a big deal. We're very much working on this because we're a human rights group, and we have an affiliate in Malaysia, and abuse of women and children and others and trafficking is something that just cannot be tolerated.
So they didn't change the situation. They just described it differently and pretended it was better in this document, is basically.
Yeah, in other words, they cooked the books, they changed the data, they told the experts that they were overruled.
Mm.
It was the experts who went to the press on the side,
Mm-hmm. And so then you even had Reuters.
Yeah.
I know it's impossible to speculate. When you say that elected officials are in the pocket of these companies and, there are ample financial rewards and everything. But how much – this always goes to the question of how much do people need? What is the inducement, for elected officials particularly on the sort of mainstream moderate side, to do this? What do they think they're up to there?
Well, I think a lot of them would be otherwise inclined
like
to
that.
Do, because people, these are the people who get along and go along, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're interested in their own careers and so forth, but they're politicians. They keep, their finger in the air. They know which way the wind is blowing. And they can see that this is, there's a public revolt coming, and they want to be on the right side of it if they want to stay around for a while.
Why would they even care to be in politics if they have if they're such sellouts and they have such a good, pay on the corporate side? Why would they even care to remain in government?
Well, a lot of them do leave, but, some like the game. And of course, you have to be in government for a certain number of years in order to establish the contacts and the reputation that would allow you to make millions as a lobbyist.
Mm-hmm.
So, and some of them just like the game, it's like some people are interested in bridge or something. I mean, it's hard to describe. It's something I'm very familiar with, but I can't paint a word picture of it.
What do your international counterparts, in other countries and European environmental groups, what do people, from abroad think of this incredible spectacle of, this attempt to really do this monolithic takeover?
Oh, well, there is a very vigorous campaign by environmental groups led by Friends of the Earth affiliates in the Pacific Basin, and Friends mm-hmm. of the Earth International based in Amsterdam, and
mm-hmm.
then the International Trade Union Confederation, and Australia is mm-hmm. a big union country, and
mm-hmm.
And that's actually the only one I can think of right now. But, well, I guess Chile to a certain extent. But, we are seeing, and actually Friends of the Earth Malaysia is having an impact. I told you the Malaysian minister left Atlanta early.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been publicizing the ways in which the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement violates President Obama's promise in the United Nations not too many days ago to implement the UN Sustainable Development Goals in order to have environmentally sensible, socially fair ways of getting economic growth, especially in the developing world. And he gave a stirring speech, you know, like his convention speeches or his campaign speeches. It was very progressive and strongly supportive. The United States was going to totally committed to implementing the UN Sustainable Development Goals. Well, I did an analysis and just showed a whole list of direct contradictions between the UN Sustainable Development Goals and specific provisions, specific language in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. That's a little bit wonky for a radio audience, but it has. There's been a very significant response, especially internationally, especially in TPP countries in the Global South, to our press release and to our report, because this is something people really care about in those countries.
Could you give one example of, you know, what he said and what, you know, would happen under the deal?
Well, climate change, probably the most important one of the UN Sustainable Development Goals is to, you know, by whatever means necessary, prevent global warming that will change our whole way of life, especially in the Global South, since it's the equatorial countries that will suffer the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement establishes investment courts that would allow Chevron and ExxonMobil to sue countries or state and local governments or local port authorities or anybody else who would seek to regulate the continued and ramped up extraction and shipment and export of coal, oil, and LNG gas, which is much worse than regular natural gas in terms of climate. In the same way, these investment courts have attacked government programs that encourage renewable energy over fossil fuel energy, a major case called the Ontario Feed-in Tariff case, to use a wonky name. The
mm-hmm.
World Trade Organization found the province of Ontario's attempt to move from a carbon-based economic policy to one that's based on renewables, and the World Trade Organization found that to be illegal under international trade law. And there are actually provisions in these agreements that in many respects forbid export controls, because, you know, we want to maintain some controls on LNG exports, and there is currently a ban for the U.S. to export crude oil. The lobbyists want to eliminate those and prevent any new export bans from being put in place, and they want to stop local governments from denying zoning permits for export terminals, for example. Excuse me just a second, I'm getting hoarse.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Forgive me.
That's okay. Well, those are two very serious examples. I mean,
yeah, and there are others, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just, it's just huge. So, I mean, how can one talk of, you know, aggressively being sustainable while permitting that kind of kibosh on, you know, the development on the one side of renewables and the containment of these other major contributors to climate change on the other side? It's a completely inconsistent position to hold.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the most cynical kind of politics. You say one thing and you do the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yep. Well, that's been one of the, I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, Bernie Sanders is, you know, appealing to so many people. People are thirsty for someone who is consistent and is clear in their and consistent in their positions, and not only because he decided he came, you know, springing up from you know, we're not sure where, and with a relatively low profile, and then suddenly became a high-profile person, and we just, you know, believe what we were hearing, but someone who's been consistent in their positions for many years and has a, you know,
right,
a long-standing record to fall back on. I think that's very important, is to look at the record, because, you know, politicians, they go from news bites, and no matter how articulate or appealing an individual might be or whatever their current news bite is, you have to be able to look at a long-standing record and a history, you know, if that's a cautionary for us at this
right,
point
absolutely,
in time. So what do you recommend as we kind of, you know, head to the last couple of minutes of the show? What do you recommend that our listeners do to stay in the loop and participate in this protection against these treaties?
Well, I would strongly urge listeners to be in touch with their U.S. senators and their U.S. members of the House of Representatives to let them know that, you know, we want to protect food safety, and we want protections against dangerous chemicals and cosmetics and other things, and we want to protect the environment. Most of all, we want to protect the climate, and that means that people need to ask in no uncertain terms for a no vote on the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Mm-hmm. Well, aye to that. So, you know, listeners, you can go to friendsoftheearth.org, FOE.org, and sign up to get posts and blogs and press releases and all of that, and stay in touch and check, you know, follow them on Facebook and take action. There's also a group called Flush the TPP. There's Public Citizen has a group called Global Trade Watch. These are all, and of course, my show, Connect the Dots, continues to cover and promote these protective activities. If you're new to this, and this is the first show on these treaties that you're hearing, you can go to the Connect the Dots archives and search William Warren and Connect the Dots, and you'll find a whole series of shows that we did that really kind of lay the groundwork for all of this and really get delve further in. The other thing that's going to be interesting and that I, you know, look forward to is I'm sure that as hard as it's going to be to really analyze such complex and global agreements in this 90-day window that will be allocated, I know that there will be many groups and that you and your group will be one of them that will be, you know, Bill Warren of Friends of the Earth, who will be poised, you know, to do that analysis. So we'll look forward to having you back here when, you know, it becomes clearer what the portent of some of these provisions are in these special areas of interest, food, health, and the environment. So thank you so much for rejoining me again on Connect the Dots. So wonderful to have you back, and glad that we're looking at a better scenario than when we thought that there would, you know, that we had all was lost and we couldn't stop these treaties. So, you know, good luck with all the fine work you're doing, and thank you for all the fine work you're doing. And listeners, you know, support Friends of the Earth and follow some of these other organizations so that you too can be involved.
Thank you so very much, Allison.
Thank you, listeners, for being with us for another edition of Connect the Dots. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Check in next week. And be well this coming week. I'm Allison Rose Levy.
Where?